Argument is Andrews versus Indiana State Police Department, Mr. Fisher.
May it please the court. Title VII's religious accommodation right goes far beyond the free exercise right as defined in Employment Division versus Smith. And therefore, like RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is invalid as Section 5 legislation. Smith, of course, ruled that neutral laws...
Counsel, I'm worried about the question whether this case presents that argument. Your brief discusses briefly the question whether the Marion County Office of Family and Children is the state for purposes of the 11th Amendment, but it seems to me your position can't go anywhere without our overruling circuit precedent. And why should we overrule circuit precedent for the purpose of precipitating some constitutional clash?
Well, because there would be a conflict otherwise with the Indiana Supreme Court on the issue as to whether these county offices
well,
are family and children.
That's fine, but we have our view of the 11th Amendment. The Indiana Supreme Court has a different one.
I think that the JAW presents reasons that were not present when Baxter was decided, in addition to its own persuasive analysis as to why the offices, local offices in of family and children should be treated as arms of the state. The main one being that the operational expenses, it's now clear that the operational expenses come from the state.
That's an argument. That's an argument that the Supreme Court of the United States has considered and expressly rejected. The Supreme Court has held that it makes no difference who pays in the end. The case is Regents of the University of California against Doe. About the same year that JAW was decided. So if the reason you're giving why we should overrule our case is that, no, we're not going to go in the teeth of a 9-0 decision by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, it's also a holding as a matter of state law that I think that it's clear that when that is the deciding factor about whether an office is an arm of the state, these matters of state law, this court typically looks to the state's highest authority, the state Supreme Court, on holdings of matters of state law.
This is a question of the meaning of the 11th Amendment. What is a state for purposes of the 11th Amendment? That's not a question of state law. State could not declare, as JAW appears to, that so far as Indiana law is concerned, counties are the state. Can't declare that cities are the state. That's a question of federal law.
I understand, Your Honor. Let me offer a way perhaps to distinguish Baxter then, which is that Baxter was about claims for benefits. This is an employment discrimination claim. The office could be treated differently with respect to the type of activity at stake as to whether the office is actually an arm of the state, and therefore Baxter would not need to be overruled in that context, but could be distinguished. There's also, of course, the Endress case, which is against the state police.
Yeah, and my big question for the Endress case is how the plaintiff has a claim at all for accommodation. I mean, I thought we had been reasonably clear in cases like Ryan and Rodriguez against Chicago that public safety officers can't pick and choose their duties, that accommodation provision of Title VII just doesn't have that feature. So I hope you see my problem. It looks like one of the plaintiffs has a claim that is not a good accommodation claim, and in the other case, the defendant is not the state. And it's therefore very hard to see why we should have this deep constitutional decision-making.
I think with respect to Endress, it's important to bear in mind that the sovereign immunity claim should precede the failure to state a claim on which relief can be granted.
Why?
Because it's
the Supreme Court held just last year that the question whether the statute states a claim for relief precedes the 11th Amendment and Section 5 question.
Well, it was... The 11th Amendment question is the question that was presented to the district court.
I understand that, but the Supreme Court has told us that whether there is a federal statutory claim comes first. And that's why, for example, when somebody sues the state under Section 1983, which was the case in the Supreme Court's case, the Supreme Court said there's no 1983 claim, and therefore we don't consider any constitutional arguments. We just say there's no claim.
Well, and part of what worries me about disposing of it in that respect at this point is that there may be a theory. Granted, in light of this Court's decisions, I don't know what that theory might be, but there may be a theory according to which the state police's rejection might violate Title VII. I don't believe there is one, but as we point out in the brief, what concerns...
Not really. It's actually, I think their argument is actually frivolous in light of Rodriguez. I mean, nothing is more absurd than the notion of police on religious or other grounds deciding whom to protect. You know, the policeman says, I don't wish to protect atheists, right? That's essentially what's going on. This person disapproves of gambling on religious grounds. That's fine, but you can't run a police force in which police decide who in the community is worthy of his protection.
In our brief, I'm really willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on the frivolousness question. And that's
I don't know what that means. Frivolous suits don't engage the jurisdiction of the federal courts. And you don't say, well, it's not frivolous because, after all, there might be a theory somewhere here that made it sound reasonable.
Well, I'm not sure how else to respond to that other than we have only presented the 11th Amendment issue at this point, and I understand the point about how it can otherwise be resolved.
Okay, well, why don't you make your 11th Amendment, or, you know, anything you want to add to your brief about the 11th Amendment, why don't you do that?
I think it's important to bear in mind what this Court had said in Erickson about the role of legislative history and the role of burden shifting when we evaluate whether a law is congruent or proportional to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Erickson said that notwithstanding any difference between the undue hardship standard, rebuttal standard under the ADA and the compelling interest standard under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the key to knowing that that was an incongruent law, that the ADA was an incongruent law, was the shift in the burden from the plaintiff to the government, that otherwise lawful actions, that is lawful under the Constitution, would be prima facie unlawful. And then going beyond that, in determining whether there was a sufficient sort of legislative history that would provide a gateway into whether Congress was remedying some sort of discrimination that was achieved through otherwise permissible means, the key to the history was whether permissible conduct was being used to achieve impermissible goals. And there is nothing like that here in the legislative history. At most, there are mentions of some employers who perhaps wouldn't provide religious accommodations because they are incapable of absorbing the costs, essentially. But there's no suggestion in the legislative history behind the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that the employers or government agencies would use some sort of manipulation of individual accommodations to achieve religious discrimination. And those are key aspects of why this is invalid Section 5 legislation.
Go back to a second to Judge Easterbrook's question. The JAW decision, apart from its conception of the 11th Amendment, did it point to any factual errors in our decisions?
I don't think that there were. I don't recall any factual errors off the top of my head, except that there was a difference in terms of the taxation that I pointed out. I think that was the main key thing that came up since then, and thorough evaluation of how the chain of command worked, that these local offices are controlled all the way up to the governor, which is clear now. And I think that based on those rationales and looking at Port Authority versus Hess, went through the facts.
Well, when I said factual, misconception of the structure of government. I mean, have we misconceived the relation between these county offices and the governor, for example? Is that the problem?
Well, I'm not sure there was a lot of discussion in Baxter about that, but certainly JAW made it clear that the chain of authority goes up to the governor, and certainly the statutes make it clear that the chain of authority goes up to the governor in terms of appointed powers, that these offices are controlled by the county offices, the state office of Family and Social Services Administration, and there is in terms of who controls the employees and what they're doing, they are governed by state personnel policies, the State Department of Personnel. They're within the jurisdiction of the state in that regard, and their paychecks come from there, and their any tort claims would come from state coffers.
That's very common, though, with local government. So, but I thought you said, what is the governor's control now?
As we point out in our brief, the governor is ultimately responsible for what goes on because I think the point is that the governor, and I spell that out in the brief, and I just can't put my finger on it at the moment, but the governor appoints the head of the state agency, who appoints a subordinate head of a subordinate agency, and eventually that chain of command works its way down to these county offices of family and children, so that there is responsibility.
Are you saying this county office is actually part of the State Department of Welfare?
I think that's the determination that we've got from JAW, is that...
Well, I mean, either is or it isn't. So does that mean the governor or the governor's appointees appoints the head of the office?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
So it's actually... So you're saying this is just a local office of the State Department?
Functionally, yes. It's called the County Office of Family and Children, but I think functionally it is a local office of state government. Here it is. Every Indiana county has an office of family and children. Each county office has a director who's a merit employee hired from a list maintained by the State Personnel Department and appointed by the Director of the State Division of Family and Children. In turn, the Director of the State Division of Family and Children is appointed by the Secretary.
Right, now that we understand. So you're saying this Director of the State Department appoints the head of the local office.
That's right.
Rather than having, county elections or some county executive appointing the person.
That's correct.
So that's your basic point about why it's part of the state.
That's right. There's a chain of command that goes right to state government.
Okay, thank you.
And I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Ms. Harrington?
May it please the court, my name is Sarah Harrington. I represent the United States as intervener in these cases. Excuse me. I'd like to begin by addressing your concerns about the cases, your holdings in Ryan and Rodriguez, to try to convince you that you do need to discuss the 11th Amendment question, at least with respect to the plaintiff in the Andres case. I believe both the holdings in both Ryan and Rodriguez are distinguishable from the facts of this case. In Ryan, I believe the holding was that the plaintiff was fired for insubordination and did not request a reasonable accommodation from his employer, and therefore none needed to be provided. In Rodriguez, I believe the holding was that the employer had...
The accommodation he requested was that he not be assigned to investigate peaceful protests of military activity, like pouring blood on military records.
But I believe
that was the accommodation he wanted, that he not work on those kinds of cases where he thought people should not be investigated or prosecuted for religious reasons.
My understanding of the facts, though, is that he refused the assignment before he requested that accommodation. And that is not, Title VII doesn't require an employer to allow an employee to refuse an assignment without requesting an accommodation. Similarly, in Rodriguez, I believe the holding was that the employer had in fact offered a reasonable accommodation, had offered a transfer to the officer who had refused.
No, but we made clear in Rodriguez, Rodriguez didn't want to protect abortion clinics. And I thought we made clear that you can't have a police force in which the police officers decide who is worthy of their protection. It is extremely demoralizing for people engaged in lawful activities to discover there is a segment of the police force which won't work for them. So, and this is exactly the same case.
Well, that was certainly the thrust of your concurrence in that opinion. I'm not sure that the majority in that opinion made that holding. I believe the holding of the case was that a reasonable accommodation had been offered and refused, and that was all the employer needed to do. But in any case, this case comes to you without any factual development. The plaintiff, Andres, has stated in his complaint that he requested a transfer and was refused.
What factual development? He doesn't want to be assigned to casinos because he has religious objections to gambling. Well, that's just like Ryan and Rodriguez.
Again, in Ryan, I believe there was no request for a reasonable accommodation.
Well, what's a reasonable? I don't understand how you can have a reasonable accommodation when what you're saying is these people, although engaged in lawful activities, are not worthy of police protection by me because of my religious beliefs.
Well, the majority of
you can see it mushrooming. So you have one group of police. You know, you have the non-Catholics protecting the abortion clinics and the Protestants protecting the casino. Yeah, this kind of balkanization of the police.
They have to be the Catholics protecting the casinos. I mean, bingo is a Catholic crowd. The Protestants stayed away for a while.
Well, certainly I think if the facts of a particular case have spun in that direction, a police department could say, look, it's not reasonable for us to accommodate any of your requests.
What does the FBI do? Ryan was, of course, a member of the FBI, and you are from the Department of Justice, the same Department of Justice representing the FBI in the Ryan case.
Yes, sir.
Told us, stood right there and told us there is no need ever to accommodate somebody who does not want, on religious grounds, to protect a given segment of the population or enforce some law. Has the Department of Justice seen some burning bush on the road to Chicago?
I'm afraid that it's just a different part of the Department of Justice that's before you today.
The Department of Justice just claims a right to talk out of both sides of its mouth when convenient.
No, I don't think that's a fair assertion.
That's what you just asserted. You said, I'm from a different part of the Department of Justice, so I can say the opposite of what the Department of Justice said in Ryan.
I don't mean to be flip about it. I wasn't here for Ryan. I'm not sure what exactly the circumstances of that case were. I think it's possible that a court could hold that it would be unreasonable in any circumstances for the FBI to grant any kind of accommodation in that case. That hasn't been the holding of this court yet, and so I think it's still an open question. I think you need some factual development of the facts in this case to determine what sort of accommodation Officer Andres really wants, what sort of burden that would impose.
The burden in these cases is not the financial inconvenience to the police force. It's the symbolic significance of saying to police, yes, you can pick and choose whom you protect. That's the burden. And you can see why a police department say, no, you've got to go where we tell you. You know, it's so fundamental that people who serve the public can't pick and choose whom they protect.
Yeah, I certainly understand your point. I believe.
I mean, should I say I don't want to sit in this case because I don't like gambling?
I hope not.
So,
I believe this court has held, however, that the question of what is a reasonable accommodation is a factual question. And so I think it would be inappropriate for this court to look at this case in this posture and determine whether what Plaintiff Andres requested was, in fact, a reasonable accommodation. I think it's more appropriate to address the jurisdictional question, the 11th Amendment question, and then if you affirm the district court's opinion, send it back for some factual development of what is reasonable.
We've developed all sorts of rules under the... You know, when you have recurrent cases presenting recurrent factual issues, I mean, we've said, for example, with regard to accommodation and disability cases, you do not have to create a new job.
Right.
So we've said that's a rule. And similarly, we are, I think, moving to a rule which says that the public safety departments do not have to reassign people on the basis of a religious antipathy. You have a fire department. Says, yeah, I'm not gonna. If there's a fire in an abortion clinic, you call some other guy to put it out. I'm not going to do that, right? So.
Well, Well, in the Ryan case, I believe before it came to the point where the officer was fired for insubordination, he had worked out with his colleagues ways of treating shifts, and that may also be true in the Rodriguez case. I can't quite remember. If there is evidence in this case that Andres had tried to work that out and the employer had said no, that might be sort of a different kind of case where you would say, well, that's not reasonable for them to refuse to allow officers to work out among themselves.
Well, that's even worse, it seems to me. So instead of having the commanders of the police or the fire department tell people where to work, the police and firemen make their own deals.
Well, in this case, if I'm...
So the commander says, X, go to the casino, and says, no, I've made a deal with Y. Y goes there, and I go to the abortion center.
Well, in this case, the assignment wasn't by a lottery system, so there's no indication that the department particularly wanted Officer Andres on the gambling boat. It was a lottery. He was the first one picked, and that's why he was considered.
Let me just ask you a quick question about this Marion County Office of Family and Children. Do you agree with Mr. Fisher's characterization that it's the local office of the state welfare department? It's not part of some at least semi-autonomous county government?
We have no position on that. We intervened only to address the limits of the question. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Harrington. Mr. Aiden?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Aiden, and I represent Ben Andres in this action. Gentlemen, the first thing I'd like to do is respectfully disabuse you of any notion that Ben Andres would not report to a gambling boat to protect the people on the boat. He would certainly do so. He would certainly report if he were to report as a law enforcement officer. But he was to report as a gaming officer. One of the functions of the gaming officer is to make sure that the equipment works, that there's no fraud, that the rules of gambling are...
enforce a particular set of laws, like the law against fraud.
Yes, Your Honor.
Protecting gamblers. What does it mean, protecting gamblers against fraud and against fires?
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. But the other reason why this is a different case, I think, from Rodriguez, is that Ben Andres, this is one of the perils, actually, of deciding this kind of case on a 12B6 motion, which is that the complaint states the exact same claim as the claimant in Rodriguez did. It said that being a gaming officer was a direct conflict with his faith, that it coerced him to either give up his Baptist faith or to keep his job. Title VII required accommodation. That's what this court said in Rodriguez.
That's a very long list, you know. I suppose they couldn't be assigned to robberies at liquor stores because it's an element of Baptist faith that people should not drink.
Not so, Your Honor.
It is an element of Baptist faith. So he chooses which parts of Baptist faith he will implement and not.
Your Honor, what Title VII is about is the right of a Hindu not to be assigned to a hot dog stand when there's an opening at the salad bar. It's about the right of a Jewish male.
No, come on, hey,
Your
please.
Honor, Your Honor, it's about the right of a Jewish male.
Don't interrupt us.
I apologize.
This is not a jury case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're talking about public safety officers. We're not talking about people working at hamburger stands.
Your Honor, can I try again? There's another reason that I'd like to point out. The interest of the government in this case is non-existent. When Indiana decided who would go to the gaming boat, what did it do? Did it look at records, training, what? It didn't do any of that. It rolled the dice. It had a lottery. How ironic. And he lost the lottery.
Entirely appropriate to decide who goes on gambling detail.
Your Honor, Indiana has an interest in ensuring that its officers obey orders. We're not arguing with that, but the interest here was only in requiring that Ben Andres be in the lottery. They could have simply said, Ben, we're not rolling the dice for you. That's all that was required here. The only thing that Indiana had to do to accommodate Ben Andres was to leave him out of the lottery, and that it would not do. It's like Patricia Holmes. The only thing that Indiana had to do to accommodate Patricia Holmes was to tolerate her religious expression, and that it would not do. Title VII is about...
By the way, what is the... I've read what she wore. Gelis is the way it's pronounced?
Yes, Your Honor. It's an aspect of a West African religion that's adhered to by hundreds of millions of Africans and African-Americans.
Could you describe it to me?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a head wrap. The folks that adhere to the Ifa faith, IFA, I believe it is, have a period of cleansing where they wear certain coloring and leaves and different items in their hair, and to retain it on their head, they have to wear this head wrap called the Gelis. It symbolizes a period of purification for them. For that reason, it's much like a Jewish yarmulke, because it's a sign of a faith that is ancient, in some ways even more ancient than the Jewish faith. And in Patricia Holmes' case, they would not do so much as to accommodate her need to be accepted from the dress code requirement.
Are you making strictly an accommodation case claim, or are you also making a disparate treatment claim?
I would say that Patricia Holmes' case is also a disparate treatment case, Your Honor.
Well, that, I suppose you're the wrong one to ask about this, but if you're making a disparate treatment claim, that raises another question about an interlocutory appeal. Because a disparate treatment claim does not depend on the accommodation section. And if there's a disparate treatment claim here, the state has no, even if this welfare agency is the state, it has no right not to be tried. We're not asking here anymore whether the state has to face the charges in federal court. We're just asking what legal theories are open. I wonder whether that's within our appellate jurisdiction.
Your Honor, that is certainly for the court to decide. Let me submit, however, that...
Do you have any views on that?
I do.
It's more a problem for your adversary than for you, but I would welcome your thoughts on it.
Yes, Your Honor. You characterize the accommodation provision as a law or part of the statute. I would respectfully submit it's actually a definition of religion, which is supposed to be congruent with the First Amendment's definition of religion.
The question I'm asking is one about appellate jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. I really cannot speak to that aspect of it except to say that I think that whether it's... I would have to say, Your Honor, as I think on my feet, that perhaps there is not jurisdiction over that aspect of Patricia Holmes' case because it doesn't depend on accommodation. You are correct. It depends on disparate treatment. Allow me to point out, however, that I believe that this accommodation provision of Title VII is not a substantive provision in the sense that it's a separate statute to enforce. It's a definition of religion, which is not a self-defining term in the statute. Congress did not define the word religion in 1964 when it passed the Act. It defined it in 1972, and it defined it because it was clear that the courts did not have enough guidance under this federal statute to determine what is religious. Is belief, action, profession religious? The Supreme Court says it is. To this day, after Oregon versus Smith, the Amish still have a right not to educate their children past the eighth grade. That's an exception. The Jehovah's Witnesses still have a right not to have their children salute the flag. That's a neutral rule of general application in schools, but they're exempted from it. What Indiana is trying to do is...
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, Your Honor, I'm saying that in the...
The holding of Barnett was not that the Jehovah's Witnesses were exempt from the rule. The holding was that no one could be compelled to salute the flag.
Your Honor, it was both a free exercise and a free speech case. So it was at least based in part on their faith. And that is true. That
was the reason why they didn't want to do it. But the holding of Barnett is that no one can be compelled to salute the flag.
And that is
right. And the reason... It's not a holding only that people... for religious reasons can't be compelled, but people who for civic reasons don't want to do it can be compelled.
That is correct.
It is not a religious exception.
It is part and parcel of a religious exception, Your Honor. I see that my time is up, and I thank the panel.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Aiden. Ms. Albright?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Debbie Albright. I represent the appellee, Patricia Holmes. I had reserved a minute because I thought there might be some factual questions that the court might have with respect to...
Well, do you have any position on the status of this of the Marion County Office, Family and Children? Whether it's part of the State Department of Welfare, or whether it is part of some semi-autonomous county government?
I think I understand the court's point on that. I guess my position would be I got the case as it was pled. My client was a pro se litigant, and she had put in her complaint that she was a state employee. So that's how we briefed the case. We think this is a county welfare office. All the other proceedings were stayed at the point where the motion to dismiss was filed. We could, I assume, go back and amend the complaint to do a better job of showing that this is, in fact, just a county office.
Yeah, one doesn't show these things in complaints. The question is, what is the right legal characterization of this? We can look up the state laws and figure it out. And like my colleague, I would appreciate knowing your views on what the right characterization is.
We have very little to dispute the state's position in this matter. There were some additional changes in the Indiana law that we feel made it pretty clear that these county welfare offices were intended to be basically arms of the state government.
Thank you.
So on that view, county is just a description of where it's located rather than the jurisdiction that contains it.
I can't dispute that.
Well, do you agree with it?
Go ahead, you might as well.
Yeah. I don't have enough specific knowledge as to the state organization to do anything other than mislead you on that, and I really don't want to do that.
Appreciate it.
I don't know if this is if this is in the record. Now, she's a nurse? Is she a
no, she's just a clerk in the welfare office.
Just a clerk.
Office.
Just a
yeah.
Welfare. I see. So, so she has no contact with patients. There's no medical dimension. It's just a clerical position.
No.
How large is this headdress?
It's a tight-fitting scarf. It's not a giant thing with horns on it, Your Honor. Okay.
The flowers are metaphorical.
Yeah. This is not within the four corners of the complaint, but it was an orange scarf, tight-fitting, similar to what a cancer patient might wear to hold the herbs and the pigments that her purification ritual required her to have in her hair for a couple of days.
Now, Mr. Aiden suggested that really she has he's really claiming deliberate religious discrimination rather than just a failure to bend the rules. Is that your understanding of your client's claim?
I think a fair reading of her pro se complaint is that she alleged both.
Yeah, I must say I'm less worried about her complaint than about what she alleges, right? Since in litigation you can prove anything consistent with a complaint, you don't have to plead facts. So what is her claim? Does she think that the welfare office allows other people to wear head coverings?
Exactly. Yes.
Yes. Well, then she's necessarily has a disparate treatment claim.
Right, and that is somewhat different from the other situation. She has there was supposedly a workplace policy that said we don't wear hats and headgear. The employer basically allowed people to wear baseball caps and stuff in. She goes in with her religious scarf, and they make a big issue out of that.
Right. Serious disparate treatment claim if the employer allows secular head coverings but not religious head coverings.
Correct. And Mr. Aiden's right. All they had to do in this situation was just tolerate her coming to work and doing her regular job in a scarf. It wouldn't be any different if a Jewish man wore a yarmulke to work or a Catholic woman came back from lunch with a ash on her forehead from a Ash Wednesday service. There was really no burden on the employer at all. And as the district court opinion points out, in situations where there isn't any burden on the employer, yet the employer's not willing to accommodate the employee anyway, there's probably something unconstitutional going on.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Albright. Mr. Fisher, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly feel obligated to begin with Judge Easterbrook's question about continuing appellate jurisdiction in light of an assertion of discrimination.
We've got a disparate treatment claim here, and the welfare office is therefore going to have to go through the litigation anyway. Why do we have appellate jurisdiction?
I think the theory is that she, as counsel has noted, two claims. There is an accommodation claim specifically mentioned. They're clarifying now that there is also a discrimination claim. If it goes back down in a position where the accommodation claim remains alive and the discrimination claim remains alive, then both get tried. The state becomes subject to liability even though later.
But that's fine. The rationale for interlocutory appellate review is that the person filing the appeal is claiming a right not to be tried. And that can be vindicated only by intervention before trial. But if there's a disparate treatment claim here, there is no conceivable right not to be tried. So I wonder why we're here.
I think the right not to be tried is the right not to be tried as to the accommodation claim.
I don't think this is theory by theory. There's either a right not to be tried or not.
Well,
and otherwise one could appeal before trial and say, look, they're going to claim damages of $300,000. We think the maximum is $200,000.
We claim a right not to be tried on the difference between $200,000 and $300,000.
It's not just a statutory limitation, but a constitutional right to the dignity of the state not to be tried on a particular claim that's beyond.
There isn't any right not to be tried, dignity right not to be tried on a particular claim. We're dealing with the venue of this litigation. And that's all the 11th Amendment is about. It's a venue rule. And if we know that this litigation's proper venue is in federal court, awfully hard to see what else to fight about.
I want to take one more stab at it. The definition of the proper venue of the litigation has to be limited to the discrimination claim and doesn't extend to the accommodation claim. That's the same amount of time. So thank you.
Do you have cases on this?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I don't. Off top of
it hasn't head. Been discussed.
It hasn't been discussed
in the brief, so we don't know. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel.